Well, thanks very much for joining me today for the second episode of season number 2 of the Healthy Skeptic MD podcast. I'm Dr. Michael Hochman. Today, we're going to continue our focus, which we've been doing all season, on key medical decisions that we all should be aware of. Last week, we spoke with Dr. Rita Redberg, a cardiologist, about the pros and cons of taking a daily statin to protect your heart. Next week, we're going to be talking about tonsillectomies and ear tubes and the pros and cons of that with a pediatric ear, nose, and throat surgeon. That's going to be a great episode, so be ready for that. And today we're going to talk to a primary care doctor, my own brother, Dr. Stephen Hochman, about routine annual labs and whether or not these are necessary to get. Now, you may remember Stephen. He was on the November 20th episode of The Healthy Skeptic talking about homeless healthcare. It was a really good episode. So if you missed that one, go back and check it out. Today, Stephen may challenge your assumptions about how important these routine labs that many of us do get each year, how much value they really do add, and some unintended consequences of them. So stick around for the interview. If you're enjoying The Healthy Skeptic, if you find it engaging and making you think more about your health, please do subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts or to the YouTube channel. Search Healthy Skeptic MD. Please also, if you have a chance, leave a review. That really helps to get out there. And please do pass along The Healthy Skeptic MD information to any friends, colleagues, and family members or others who might be interested. Okay, so before we get into our discussion of routine labs, as always, let's do a quick rundown of the health news for the week. And also this week, before we get into the health news, I want to just bring up one really good listener question I got. Someone who saw the discussion last week with Dr. Rita Redberg and asked me a question about statin medication. So she said she's a woman in her 70s. She takes rosuvastatin, 5 milligrams, 3 times a week. This is a very low dose, much lower than what's been studied. So there might be less side effects, but also less benefits from a dose this low. That's one thing to note. She says she does have a high LDL or bad cholesterol. She has calcium deposits in her coronary arteries on CAT scan. That's something we'll come back to, but it is an indicator of coronary artery disease, but she's never had a heart attack or stroke or anything like that. She says she has had a healthy lifestyle. She walks at least a mile a day, and she has one doctor who wants to keep her on the statin medication and another one who wants her to stop it. And personally, she'd rather not be on it if she doesn't have to be. So she wanted to know what I thought. The first thing I would say is if she had any side effects whatsoever, any muscle aches or any other side effects that you might attribute to the statin medication, I certainly would stop it, because something with a low benefit like this is just not worth it if you're having side effects. The other thing that caught my attention, she says she has a healthy lifestyle, and I'm sure she does, but she says she walks at least a mile a day, and you know, that's not nothing. That's more than many Americans do, but I wonder if there's any way she could make that 2 1-mile walks a day. And I think if she were able to do that, it would have a lot more benefit to her heart, not to mention her health in general, than the statin medication would have. So just something to keep in mind. And then if it were me, I don't like the idea of being on a daily medication unless I absolutely have to be. So I would probably err on the side of not taking it in her circumstance. But as we discussed with Dr. Redberg last week, there is a small but real benefit. About 1 person out of 100 who takes a statin medication for 2.5 years will avoid a heart attack. And that's certainly nothing to scoff at. So someone could certainly take an alternative viewpoint on this one. Okay, so the first health item I want to touch on is the topic of schools reopening during the COVID-19 pandemic. There's been a lot of discussion this week in Chicago. The Chicago public schools are planning to reopen despite a fair amount of resistance from a lot of teachers and some community members there, but they're planning to do it. And we actually got a batch of new studies this week providing a lot of reassuring data about the risks of school reopening. So the first was a study in North Carolina, published in the Journal of Pediatrics, that examined the experience there with schools reopening. North Carolina did a real big push and kept a lot of schools open. The authors of that study concluded that policies like masking, distancing, hygiene resulted in minimal infections of SARS-CoV-2 occurring in schools, very low rates of transmission in schools, and it did not trigger larger community infection outbreaks. Our data indicate that schools can reopen safely if they develop and adhere to specific prevention policies. There was also an article in the New England Journal describing the Swedish experience. In Sweden, as many people know, they did keep schools and many other institutions open. That New England Journal study very interestingly found that teachers were actually no more likely, and in some cases appeared to be a bit less likely, than other professions that were working to be infected. So that's reassuring. And then finally, there was a Norwegian study that tracked children who had SARS-CoV-2 to find out how frequently they were spreading. And certainly there were some instances in which they identified spread, but it seemed to be quite a bit less than what has been seen with adults to adults. So again, for a variety of reasons, it does appear that kids are less likely to transmit the virus compared to adults. Now, if you want to learn more about this topic, we had a detailed discussion about this with Dr. Jessica Hockman, my wife, who's a pediatrician. Check it out. It's in the December episode of the Healthy Skeptic MD. And overall, as I see the data accumulating more and more, my view, and again, some might disagree, but my view is that the benefits to society of reopening the schools outweigh the modest risks of infection spread from doing so. So the second news item I want to discuss, also relating to schools, is that here in Los Angeles, the school superintendent for the public schools announced that when the COVID-19 vaccine becomes available in children, he plans to make this a requirement for students to return to schools. Now, I'll begin by saying that in general and philosophically, I'm a big supporter of vaccine mandates for school children, for the measles vaccine, mumps, rubella. These are vaccines with long track records that are clearly very effective. But I will say that as a parent of LA public school students, I am fairly nervous about this discussion so far. And the reason being that the COVID-19 vaccine hasn't been studied yet in kids under the age of 16, let alone FDA approved. So I really think this is a premature discussion. And I hope that we certainly don't make any mandates until there's more data and FDA approvals. And we clearly all feel comfortable that the benefits in children of the vaccine outweigh the risks. I hope we'll get there. But I don't think we're there yet, and I wish that the superintendent hadn't made this particular comment. So with that, let's jump into our discussion on routine labs with Dr. Stephen Hockman.
All right. Well, we have a repeat offender today on the Healthy Skeptic MD, Dr. Stephen Hockman. For those of you who missed the previous episode he was in, we talked about street medicine and care for homeless patients. And before we get into our discussion today about routine testing, Stephen, can you just give us a little bit of a background and a little information about what your practice is like with homeless patients?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks so much for having me again, Mike. Always a pleasure to be back. So I work for a federally qualified health center. The organization's JWCH. I work on Skid Row in downtown Los Angeles. For folks not familiar, Skid Row is a tent city in downtown Los Angeles, really close to some major landmarks like the Staples Center. The majority of my patients are struggling on a regular basis with homelessness, whether they're in and out of shelters, in and out of apartments, or just living on the street. I do a heck of a lot of work with substance abuse. I see a lot of opiate abuse, heroin and fentanyl, stimulant abuse, crystal meth, crack. But just like the rest of America, I do deal with a lot of diabetes, blood pressure, cardiovascular disease. So a really unique community in some ways, a very representative community in other ways, and definitely a really engaging community.
Well, great. So very interesting. And again, as I said last time, great work that you do for a population that really needs the help. Okay, so we are going to talk about routine screening tests today. And before we get to that, doing blood tests are important, right? I mean, if someone has symptoms or they're on medications, there are plenty of good reasons to order blood tests. So what are the common reasons that you do order blood tests as a primary care doctor?
Absolutely. So like I said, I see a lot of patients with diabetes. I see a lot of patients with high blood pressure. And most of these patients who have both of these things are taking two, three, or even more medications to treat these conditions. And so the majority of the labs I'm doing are monitoring these chronic conditions and the medication side effects, checking levels of sodium or potassium in the blood every so often. just to make sure that there's no abnormalities from blood pressure medications and things like that. These are also both conditions that affect the kidneys. So I think periodic kidney screening is really important and something that I order a lot of. And probably that chronic disease management is more than half of the labs I order. The rest of the labs I order are more specific to my patients. Like I said, I see a lot of IV drug use from heroin and fentanyl. And so I do a lot of screening for hepatitis C because that's really common with drugs of abuse. And I also see a lot of high-risk sexual behavior. So I do a lot of screening for STDs, and I think we're going to talk about those topics a little bit later specifically. But between chronic condition monitoring and special conditions like STD screening and hepatitis C screening, that's the vast majority of the labs I order.
And even for healthy patients, there are some recommended blood tests, for example, diabetes screening and cholesterol screening. When, in what circumstances are those tests recommended by the guidelines?
Well, diabetes screening, I do fairly liberally in my population, and there's a couple reasons I do that. First and foremost, the prevalence of diabetes is quite high. You know, a lot of my patients are obese themselves, have high sugar carbohydrate diets themselves, or family history. The other thing that makes diabetes screening fairly easy for me is it's one of the things we have a point of care test for. And this means that I'm able to take a small sample of blood from the patient right in the clinic and discuss the results with them 10 minutes later. So what I'll do is most patients in my practice, when I first meet them, I'll screen them for diabetes once, especially if they have any of those risk factors. I think when to follow it up becomes a little bit more difficult. If their lab value starts out abnormal or borderline, I might check it again in a year or two. Certainly if something changes in their life, like they gain a lot of weight or start having new symptoms of diabetes, like drinking a lot, peeing a lot, feeling fatigued, I'll check it again. Cholesterol is another one I do check a lot of. I generally follow the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force guideline. I try to check all my male patients when they turn 35 at least once, and all my female patients when they turn 45. That having been said, I think cholesterol is an interesting thing because what are we really asking when we check cholesterol? Well, we're really asking, are we going to start a medicine to treat cholesterol? It really doesn't matter what your cholesterol is. We want all of our patients to be having a healthy plant-based diet. We want all of our patients to be exercising regularly. So those things aren't going to change if your cholesterol is high, middle, or low. But it is useful to know whether there's going to be a benefit from starting a cholesterol medication. And so a lot of times I try to make that clear to patients when I am doing this routine screening. You know, if we get a lab that's abnormal, we're probably going to recommend starting medications. And I think it's important for patients to know where the conversation is going before we start. I think it helps sort of provide a center.
Well, that's a great pickup on our discussion last week with Dr. Rita Redberg about statin cholesterol medications. And you know, she actually makes the case that probably lifestyle changes, physical activity and exercise are so important and should be used much more commonly than medication. So it's a good one to listen to pick up there. You know, as you said, lipid screening and diabetes screening are recommended, you know, once or twice after someone turns 35 or 40, maybe every 5 years. But sometimes I see cholesterol tests ordered yearly and, you know, not that there's any major harm in doing that, but it's, you know, it always strikes me as a little silly, for lack of a better term. Ironically, many large employers will do annual wellness screens for their patients and they'll do yearly cholesterol. You know, if it motivates you to eat healthy and exercise and you can watch the numbers look get better, maybe that's a good thing, but it certainly is not consistent with what's recommended by the guidelines. Okay, so let's talk about routine blood panels. So a lot of times as a primary care doctor, I will have a patient come in and say, "Doc, give me everything. Give me the kidneys and the liver and the blood count and just do the routine screening that you always do." So is that recommended? What do you think in your practice? Is that something that you do?
Yeah. So it's funny, you know, Mike, I think any primary care doctor can relate to that. I see a lot of that in my practice. All of my colleagues see a lot of that as well. You know, when we were preparing for the show, you asked me if I had any, you know, major pet peeves and actually sort of this sort of is one for me. And I just want to clarify, I'm not frustrated that the patient is asking for blood work. You know, they're coming in and they're asking for sort of a wellness check that makes sense. I think I'm frustrated with, you know, the the difficulty in explaining, you know, why that question is a lot more complicated than it might seem. And I think to understand that, we need to understand, when does a doctor call a lab test normal or abnormal? And the way we do this is kind of interesting. We look at our entire population, a huge number of people for that lab test. We look at the middle 95% and we just call that normal. Now that makes a lot of sense, right? So if your number is with 95% of people, it's more likely you have a normal value and nothing's wrong. But that leaves 5% of normal people, 2.5% on the low side and 2.5% on the high side, who have no pathology. They just have an abnormal value for a normal person. And so that's 1 in 20 people for any given test that are going to have a number flagged as abnormal. And so, you know, that chance seems small, but then the test, that really compounds on itself when you order more and more tests. So for instance, a comprehensive metabolic panel, that's the liver and kidney check that we do, there's 20 individual tests on that. So you're giving a patient 20 times to have a 1 in 20 opportunity of having a positive test. And a lot of times when we end up ordering these large panels, one or two things come back flagged, and a patient who's feeling fine, looking for reassurance, ends up really concerned about an abnormal lab value.
Along those lines, one of my mentors when I was doing my training used to have a joke, what do you call a normal set of blood tests? And he said a case report, because it's so unusual that you'll actually have a normal test result for the exact reason that you said. If you do enough tests, you're going to find somebody who's a little bit outside of the range. And that's certainly what I experience when I commonly order these tests for my patients. But a lot of times patients will say, okay, doc, I understand that maybe it's not necessary, it's not recommended by the guidelines, but is there any harm of ordering a standard screening panel of blood tests every year?
Well, I think there's a lot that depends on how you're going to handle the results. And so similar to what we discussed before, you know, with the cholesterol screening, I think it's important before you get the lab work to understand what are we going to do with it. It's very easy in medicine to order tests, and then an abnormal test begets another. The tests tend to become more invasive the deeper we get, and potentially a treatment ends up, you know, being assigned. And if you end up having a side effect along the way from one of those subsequent tests or treatments, an initial screen of an asymptomatic patient really can become something out of nothing. But I think that if you're able to sort of be prepared for some abnormal results, think about what they mean, and you know, approach them in a sort of slow medicine, thoughtful way. I think you can minimize the harms, but I think the important thing is there's, you know, still pretty marginal benefit. There's very few times when I see the opposite, when I see, you know, oh, I checked that lab for really no indication, and the patient ended up really finding something that would have been harmful.
Yeah. Well, common routine tests are commonly done. Let me ask you about a couple specific ones, because patients are getting these all the time. So let's start with vitamin D. A lot of doctors will do an annual vitamin D test. What do you think about that?
Well, you know, I hear new stories every day about what vitamin D is going to do for people. You know, vitamin D has been linked to bone density, reduced fracture risk, reducing cardiovascular disease risk, improving male sex drive. And now it's even, you know, COVID, is it benefiting COVID? Vitamin D is a really interesting one, because when you dig into the literature, we don't actually know from randomized trials whether vitamin D supplementation does any of these things. There's no data on what levels correlate to what outcomes, and what treatments are appropriate for what levels. All the data we have is observational, and something that's unique to vitamin D but very interesting is people with high vitamin D are people who have healthy diets and get a little bit of sun outside, presumably from exercising. And if you're eating a healthy diet and getting outside for a jog a couple times a week, you're more likely to have better sex drive, you know, better response if you were to get something like COVID, lower risk of cardiovascular disease. And so is it really the vitamin D, or is it the other lifestyle things that are affecting it?
And I'll say, you know, if my patients do get their vitamin D level checked and it is a touch low, what I recommend is just get some more sunlight, be outside, be more physically fit. And they may feel better because they're getting outside more and exercising more, and probably has very little or nothing to do with the vitamin D. And of course, if somebody does have symptoms that could be due to vitamin D deficiency, sure, if they're very fatigued or tired or a specific symptom, that's a good reason to get vitamin D. But what we're just saying is for screening healthy people who have no specific symptoms. Yeah. Okay, let me ask another one that commonly comes up, thyroid screening. Do you do an annual thyroid test?
So thyroid is one I feel pretty strongly about, and I really try to avoid the asymptomatic thyroid screen. Thyroid testing is notoriously hard to interpret. It's a complex, feedback mechanism of the brain talking to the thyroid, talking to all your individual organs, and so a lot of these tests can be really hard to interpret because of this complex interplay. False positive tests, an abnormal thyroid test with really no disease is really common. We see, and when we screen, what we find is a lot of what we call subclinical thyroid disease. That's just the fancy way of saying your thyroid test was abnormal, but there's no symptom. And we know that people with this subclinical thyroid disease are more likely to progress to thyroid disease. But here's the kicker. Treating that subclinical thyroid disease, it doesn't reduce the progression of the disease, and it also doesn't actually reduce the severity of any bad outcomes from thyroid disease you have down the line. So, in essence, if you don't want to wait for something bad to happen, but if you get to the point where you're symptomatically high or low thyroid and you treat it then, you're going to be just as good off if you've been treating it all along. And converse to some of the other things where the treatments aren't, maybe less harmful. Overtreatment with thyroid hormone can be very harmful, and there's a robust literature of people who have subclinical low thyroid who get treated to being symptomatically high thyroid with abnormal heart rhythms and things like that. That can be really scary. All that having been said, I will say that I find myself ordering thyroid tests on a fairly regular basis because thyroid symptoms are fairly nonspecific, which means a lot of my patients who come in with different changes in their weight or different fatigue or different symptoms could have thyroid disease. And so when I'm working up a lot of symptoms trying to figure out what's going on, I will check a thyroid test for those patients who are symptomatic. But the last thing I'll tell you here is just a plug for the good physical exam because, really feeling a lot of thyroids, knowing when the thyroid is abnormally enlarged, knowing when it's abnormally squishy, knowing when there's a nodule somewhere, the physical exam can guide the need for further lab workup a lot better than just a test all approach.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. A thoughtful, careful, asking the right questions, history, physical exam, a lot of times is going to be a lot more valuable than a random shotgun approach with lab screening. And that applies to thyroid and many tests. That's a good one. Good point. Okay, here's one that I'm sympathetic to. A lot of times I'll have patients come in and say, doc, I'm not married, or can I get an STD panel? And certainly there are people who are at high risk and people have symptoms. We absolutely should be getting sexually transmitted infections. But what about sort of lower risk people? Does everybody need an annual STD panel? Well, what's your take on that one?
Well, I'll tell you one thing to start. If a patient asks me for an STD panel, I do it. I really, that's not one I ask. And I'll give you an anecdote about why. I had a young gentleman just about a month ago who came in asking for HIV testing. And I took a detailed sexual history, and it was really benign. It was a very few sexual partners. He reported very low risk sexual behaviors, condom use, all of those things. And then a week later, we were sitting back in the office discussing a new co-infection with both HIV and syphilis. And, there's a lot of reasons patients may be more or less honest about their sexual history, but I think a patient coming into the doctor asking for STD testing is really important to respond to. And so I will order STD testing for any patient who asks for it. Whether I ask for it on a routine basis is a little bit different. Especially with things like chlamydia, and to a lesser extent gonorrhea, there's a lot of asymptomatic patients who go around spreading it to others. And so I do think a yearly check of STDs is reasonable. At least once every couple of years, maybe once when you meet the patient every 5 years, something like that. But I don't think more frequently is wrong. What I will tell you is one thing I do is if a patient comes to me asking for yearly labs, I will often guide them much more towards getting the STD labs checked than all these other labs, because at least STD checks are easier to interpret, simple confirmatory tests to confirm whether it's a false positive or not, and relatively easy treatments with minimal side effects.
Okay, this one's not a blood test. What about an EKG, a routine EKG? Do you do that in your patients?
So routine EKGs are another one I really try to avoid. Slap a completely normal EKG from a textbook in front of a group of internists, and it's like blood in the water, finding this or that or the other thing. And I think what patients are asking us for with an EKG when they're feeling fine is really sort of a yay or nay about whether their heart is okay or not. And I think if you really want to answer that question, the best thing to do is, a detailed personal and family history for risk factors, a thoughtful exam for exertional, a thoughtful history of exertional symptoms like chest pain or shortness of breath. And then, a good cardiac examination, just using that stethoscope to listen and to look for, pulses and swelling. And I think that's going to do a lot better than an EKG that's going to most likely have insignificant findings that we don't know how to interpret. The complete flip side that I think is really interesting is the majority of coronary events occur in patients with a completely normal EKG. So just because you go to your doctor and get a normal EKG, it doesn't mean you're just safe and you don't have to think about all the other risk factors like healthy diet and exercise and all those things. So EKG is one I do try to avoid as much as possible because it's almost unhelpful on both ends of the extremes. When we find stuff, it's not very helpful. And when it's normal, it's not very helpful. And so it is one that I try to avoid.
I'm actually going to agree with you 80% on that. I don't find a lot of useful things from screening EKGs. But sometimes, especially in higher risk people, I will get a baseline one. And the only reason I do that, not to try to go down any particular path in that specific moment, but rather just so you have a baseline in case something happens down the road that you have something to compare it to. So that is something that anecdotally I can say is useful. So sometimes I'll do that in a higher risk patient of mine. Okay, here's one that I'm opening a ball of wax, and we're going to do future episodes dedicated specifically to prostate cancer screening. But let me just get your high-level thoughts on PSA screening, which is a screening blood test that's recommended for consideration among men 50 to 69. And it's one of those sort of optional ones where there's pros and cons of doing it. But do you tend to encourage it in your patients in that 50 to 69 age range?
So, you'll talk about this, the details of these numbers, I think, in a future episode. PSA is that classic issue where you have maybe a 0.1% chance that the screening test is going to sort of save a life, and then a much higher, maybe like a 5 to 10% chance of a downstream harm coming from the PSA testing. And so this is one that I think it's just really important to ask the patient, which is going to feel worse for you later? Do you really want to avoid being that one in 700 or so that might die? Or are you going to be upset if you're more like that one in 100 who has an erectile dysfunction or impotence or urinary incontinence or something like that? Now, I will say I've started ordering some more PSAs in my practice now more than I used to. And there's two reasons why. The first reason is the population I take care of. I take care of a predominantly African-American population. And a lot of my patients have family history of aggressive prostate cancer in their uncles or fathers. And, for a 55-year-old Black man who has a father who died young of prostate cancer, I think you get to a point where the benefits of screening start to become a lot more real. And so I do offer it, especially to those patient populations, at least try to educate them on their risk. The other thing about my practice that's changed a lot is the urologist that I refer to. I have a urologist now I work with that I really trust. I think he shows a really good slow medicine and thoughtful approach. He really educates my patients when they go to see them about whether they need a biopsy and how to handle that abnormal PSA result that I'm sending them for. And so, I feel really comfortable if I do get an abnormal PSA with where the patient's going to be going and that they're going to be getting good, thoughtful, slow medicine advice. And so I think that really highlights the importance of sort of knowing your network and what resources you have in primary care. And for that reason, I do order a few more PSAs than I used to. But I do agree that, personally, I think the risk-benefit ratio is not something I'd be interested in when I get to be that age. And it's not something I push with my patients.
Okay, so I think you and I are on a similar wavelength, that routine shotgun approach to labs, It's not the worst thing in the world to do, but it's probably not necessary. But yet in real world clinical practice, it happens all the time.
Well, I think there's a couple of reasons. I think, first of all, a lot of patients come to their visits well-educated. They've done their homework, and they know what they want, and they come and they ask for the tests, and it feels like the right thing to do. You know, we have all these fancy tests to do, and we want to use this technology to help people. And so I think a lot of people come in wanting these tests, and I think there's a little bit of misinformation sometimes among our patients. Medicine is more of an art than a science, and what seems like a simple lab test to the patient might not be so simple, like we've talked about with vitamin D or an EKG or a thyroid level. It's just not really an all or nothing thing. I think the second thing that drives a lot is for providers. I think it's just sort of that classic, if you ask a barber if you need a haircut, to a hammer, everything's a nail. To a doctor, we have all these tests, and at a click of a button, you can order 20 tests, and you get those results, and it seems like such a concrete way. And I think even we get tricked into forgetting that these tests are really hard to interpret. One thing I think is really funny, though, is, if you are lucky enough to get into a circumstance with a patient where they are asymptomatic and feeling fine and you're not working something up, I think a lot of doctors might fill the space with, here's the labs we're going to get. What a great chance to have a 10-minute conversation about COVID or a deep dive into healthy eating habits or something like that. I think sometimes ordering labs can be a time filler for a healthy patient in a visit when really we're often complaining we don't have enough time with our patients. And here's a great opportunity to focus on some of those other things like diet, exercise, thoughts on the health news of the day.
Has this issue ever been studied? What does the data tell us about annual routine blood tests?
So one of the things that's really interesting is we don't have a lot of data. Unfortunately, it's very hard to do randomized trials, which is, the gold standard for answering a medical question like we have here, where you're taking a bunch of asymptomatic patients who get screened or not. And so we don't have a huge amount of data. That having been said, I'll just remind you, listeners, of some of the things we talked about early in the episode. Like I talked about, routine screening for asymptomatic thyroid disease, we know leads more to a lot of overtreatment without preventing disease progression or long-term symptoms. We don't have any data that treating people with vitamin D reduces the outcomes that we're interested in with vitamin D. And we've talked about how the baseline EKG, we kind of know that in an asymptomatic patient, it doesn't necessarily rule in or out cardiac disease. So for some of those specific tests, we do know that there's not much utility in doing the tests. A lot of trials have looked at the benefit of a general medical checkup overall. Now, this would be grouping both the doctor visit and the labs. And there was a really big meta-analysis that was studied about 10 years ago, and they looked at about 180,000 people, and they showed that folks who got this general medical visit once a year were no likely to have a mortality benefit or a cardiovascular disease benefit or have really any other benefits. Now, that having been said, I actually think that, and Mike, you and I were talking about this a little bit last night, I think that that can be a bit of a misleading study. It's really hard to randomize in a study the nuances of a good history taken by a physician and a physical examination. So a lot of these studies are really, whether or not they know it, they're really checking, did you order a bunch of lab tests or not? And so I think, there is some data out there that the routine physical with all the lab tests probably doesn't make a huge difference. But I think that we know from a lot of experience that the components where you get to know your doctor, have a good relationship with them, really delve into some of the issues you might be concerned about, have a thorough physical exam that could find something. I think there's likely value there, but I think there's very unlikely value in the lab test component alone when the patient is asymptomatic.
Well said. And, although there's not as much evidence as we would like on this topic, I think it's fair to say that despite a lot of efforts to demonstrate a value from routine lab tests, there's not data that anyone can point to show a benefit. So, there's not great evidence on either side. And from the studies that have been done, they've had trouble demonstrating a benefit to patients of routine routine labs. Okay, my final question for you is, that some leading medical organizations, particularly in the name of reducing waste, have started a number of initiatives to cut back on some of this routine testing. Probably the most prominent of this is something called the Choosing Wisely campaign. Can you tell listeners, just as a final note, a little bit about the Choosing Wisely campaign and what they've said about routine lab tests?
Yeah, absolutely. So I love the Choosing Wisely campaign. I think it's a fantastic thing that's getting done. So basically, all of our different professional organizations, or a lot of them, are asked the simple question, what do doctors in your practices do that they shouldn't be doing? How do we choose wisely? And the idea was, we're probably never going to reach a perfect medical system where everything we do is perfect. But if we can find the low hanging fruit, the things we do a lot of that are probably unnecessary, we can avoid doing a lot of things in medicine that aren't helping people or worse, hurting people. And actually, almost everything we've discussed today is somewhere or other in the Choosing Wisely campaign as a recommendation. You know, Choosing Wisely recommends against the routine screening of an asymptomatic patient for vitamin D deficiency. They recommend against the routine screening of an asymptomatic patient for thyroid disease. They recommend against the routine screening of an asymptomatic patient for anemia, for checking blood counts and iron studies. And so a lot of these things are in there. I think Choosing Wisely is so beautiful for two reasons. First of all, it's free and easily accessible and easy to read. Any of the patients can open it up, and it makes sense. I mean, if you want to delve into the data and learn more, it's there. But they give a summary statement that anybody can understand, patients or clinicians. I think the other thing it does is it really empowers clinicians to stop doing things that we don't necessarily feel comfortable stopping doing. If you've been spending, you know, a 10 or 15 year clinical practice ordering labs and all your patients, or if when vitamin D tests became, you know, the rage, you started ordering a lot of them, it's really hard to stop. It's really hard to, as a solo practitioner, justify not doing all those tests anymore. And Choosing Wisely is a really great way for physicians to just look at their practice and say, wow, you know, I'm ordering all these vitamin D levels on these asymptomatic patients. And, you know, here's a well-respected professional body who evaluated the evidence, and they're telling me I don't need to be doing that. And so I really like Choosing Wisely, both recommended to my patients and to help my own practice improve.
Yep. And I'll highlight that this is something, a collaboration between the American Board of Internal Medicine and Consumer Reports, so two very well-respected organizations that have led a lot of this work. Well, thanks for joining me today, Dr. Stephen Hochman. Great take on a routine blood test. If you found today's discussion interesting, search for and subscribe to the Healthy Skeptic MD on YouTube, wherever you listen to podcasts. Please pass along to any friends or relatives or others who might be interested. And thanks again for joining me today, Stephen.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me, Mike. Always a pleasure to spend some time with you. And let's maybe catch some playoffs while the rest of the family takes care of our kids this weekend. Sound like a plan?
Absolutely. Divisional round of the NFL.
All right.
See you all next week.
Have a good one.